Everyone will stand. I will read the two verses of our opening scripture. It's Leviticus chapter 20, verses 25 and 26. Ye shall therefore put difference between clean beast and unclean, and between unclean fowls and clean. And ye shall not make your souls abominable by beast, or by fowl, or by any manner of living thing that creepeth on the ground, which I have separated from you as unclean. And ye shall be holy unto me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have severed you from other people, that you should be mine. You may be seated. I've used this verse before, where God tells that he had severed his people from other people. President Donald Trump, in a speech given at the National Day of Remembrance of the Holocaust a month ago while he was visiting an Israelite, said some things that were devastating to the Christians of the United States. In fact, it should be devastating. Trump said, whether blackmailed or not, quote, I will always stand with the Jewish people. And I will always stand with our great friend and partner, the State of Israel, unquote. What he was saying was that he will always stand with the enemies of Jesus the Christ and all Christians. He will stand with the descendants of the plotters and murderers of Jesus the Christ and the people who assassinated most of the disciples and have wreaked havoc on his church. He will stand with those who have hated the kingdom of God and who have attempted to rule it behind the scenes like the Wizard of Oz for centuries. In sermon number one, I explained where the rituals, decorations, and religious practices originated from that are now a sort of the common unbiblical holidays celebrated by the false apostate churches. In sermon two, I explained what the beast of the field signified in the Bible. In sermon three, I identified psychology as the new pseudoscience promoted by the Frankfurt School in America. It is commonest to the core, as it totally omits the God of the Bible. In today's sermon, well, you'll just have to listen and read it and see. I hope that it'll be instructive. Let's start in 2 Chronicles chapter 28 and study what was happening in the kingdom of Judah while Ahaz was king. Ahaz's father, Jotham, was a good king. Ahaz's son, Hezekiah, was also a good king. But Ahaz was an ungodly king. He was like a thorn between two roses. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign in the capital city of Judah, which was Jerusalem. He reigned for 16 years. But he was not a good ruler, for he did those things that were not right in the sight of the Lord. Ahaz committed five main sins. Number one, he walked in all the ways of the kings of the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom of Israel. How did the kings of Israel walk? Well, each king was worse than the previous one. Not one of them did what was right in the eyes of God. Number two, he made molten images for Baal. Just like the kings of Israel, he worshipped Baal too. During the days of Elijah, the northern kingdom worshipped Baal exclusively. Number three, he burned incense in the valley of the son of Hinnom. Ahaz, like our own president, prayed to another god in its own place of prayer. Remember Trump there at the Wailing Wall? Number four, he burned his children in the fire to the false god Moloch. Ahaz made a great sacrifice, but it was wrong. One son, Hezekiah, was saved from the burning fire by his wife. 5. He sacrificed and burnt incense in high places, on the hills and under every green tree. Ahaz was very religious, but he was very, very wrong. Because of these 5 sins, God delivered to Ahaz these 5 judgments upon the kingdom in which he ruled. Number 1, Judah suffered defeat by the army of Syria. Number 2, Judah had many captives taken by Syria. Number 3, Judah was defeated by the army of the northern kingdom of Israel. Number 4, in the war with Israel, 120,000 Judahites were slain in one day. Number 5, in the war with Israel, 200,000 captives of Judah were taken to Samaria with women, sons, daughters, and spoils of war. Man, that's something. This fifth judgment was reversed when God sent his prophet Obed to Samaria to tell the Israelites that he had given them the victory over Judah because he was angry at what Judah's king had done. He then informed Israel to not take their captives to be slaves, or Israel would have to face the fierce wrath of the Lord, just like Judah did. This is one time where Israel obeyed the prophet of God, and their 200,000 captives were sent home after being clothed, fed, and anointed, and their feeble ones put on donkeys. They were brought to Jericho and returned to their own tribes of people. Let us think about these numbers for a minute. In America's war between the states, both sides suffered a combined number of casualties of about 650,000 to 750,000 soldiers. It was the bloodiest war in America's history, with more casualties than all the other wars America has fought combined. It averaged a total of 175,000 soldiers killed on both sides per year. The war claimed more American lives than any other military action in which the country has taken part. The number of men dying in the war between the states is more than in all American wars from the American Revolution through the Afghanistan War combined. And consider that the American population in 1860 was about 31 million people, about one-tenth the size it is today. If the war was fought today, the number of deaths would total 6.2 million. Historians believe that two-thirds of the fatalities among soldiers serving in this deadly war were due to illnesses. 1 out of 10 white men who were of military age in 1860 died because of the war between the states. The war between the states ravaged that American population even after the bloodshed ended, taking a massive economic, religious, and political toll on the nation. An accurate tally is important to gauge the huge impact of this war on American society. It affected both sides tremendously as the Jewish plan for control of the nation reached its pinnacle of attacks. Shortly after the war, the Jews began in earnest to, number one, control America's seminaries and churches. The launch of the fraudulent Schofield Bible. Control America's politics. Samuel Untermyer took advantage of a situation to bribe President Wilson to get a Jewish person appointed to the Supreme Court and to have America enter World War I. Control of America's money supply. The creation of the Federal Reserve banking system. Control of America's people. The creation of the Internal Revenue Service and the progressive taxing of America, of the people's income. Control of the family. The creation of the doctrine of feminism, which changed completely the structure and dynamics of family life. Control of the Jewish police state. The creation of the ADL and the SPLC, which identifies hate groups in the United States. The American Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center are two of the largest Jewish groups that are backing the dismantling of the Southern flag and the monuments being taken down, destroyed, or relocated to insignificant spots. It's done to keep secret the fact that it was mainly the Jews who were the leading traders and slaves in America and other parts of the world. The Jews were the owners of the ships that transported the slaves from Africa, the South Africa, the Caribbean islands, and the North America. The Jews also owned the auction houses where the slaves were traded. Many of the Jews also owned many of the plantations where the slaves were used to plant, weed, and harvest a host of plants. Why isn't this common knowledge today? It would certainly change the argument about who the real guilty people should be in the slave days of the 1800s. This lack of information about who were the slave owners and who owned the auction houses has changed the climate in America. Where is the guilt of the Jew in all of this? Why is it that it was the Canaanite Jew who is behind most of the trouble in the world for centuries? How can you have any peace when they are dividing and causing one group to fight against another group in the same nation? And they make it against the law for anyone to fight against them. They simply cry, anti-Semite. And it all is treated as being nothing more than a conspiracy falsehood. The North versus the South was just such an action. I have always wondered, why didn't the South win if it was in the right? What was the argument about anyway? It certainly was not about slavery. Slavery was on its way out as the mechanical age was about to begin, and there would be no need for any of the expensive slaves to be used on most of the plantations. So who started the war? Was there a wizard behind the scenes directing both sides? It was like a play in which the ending changed according to how the audience decided it should end. For like almost all wars, one group of people was invested in both sides. They won no matter who won. Are you a Yankee or a rebel? If the South would have won, would it be a lot different today? As I look around me, I think it might have been just about the same if the South would have won. Why? Because they were both backed by the same group of people. Who was the wizard behind the screen on the North? I'm sure that most of you have heard the Triple Crown of horse racing. Number one, the Kentucky Derby. Number two, the Preakness. And number three, the Belmont Stakes. Yesterday, June the 9th, was the final crown of horse racing. The Belmont Stakes race was run with 12 horses, all vying for the winning cup. The race is held at the former home of the wizard behind the screen on the north side of the war. His name, August Belmont. Who was August Belmont? Well, he was the wizard behind the screen for the North. August Belmont was not the name he was born with. His original name was August Schoenberg. Both of his parents were Jewish. There's even strong rumors that his real father was Karl Rothschild, but they could either be true or false. Nevertheless, August was Jewish. His mother died when he was 7 years old. After his mother's death, he lived with his uncle and grandmother in Frankfurt, Germany. He attended this Jewish junior and senior high school until he began his first job, an apprenticeship for the Rothschilds. He would sweep floors, polish furniture, and run errands for the Rothschilds, while also studying English, arithmetic, and writing. He was then given a confidential clerkship in 1832 and promoted to private secretary before traveling to Naples, Paris, and Rome. In 1837, Belmont was assigned to Havana to manage the Rothschild branches. However, when traveling to Havana, Belmont first went to New York. He arrived during the Panic of 1837 and remained in New York instead of continuing to Havana to supervise jeopardized Rothschild interest. He changed his name to Belmont after immigrating to the United States. August Belmont, a Prussian Jew, came to the United States in the diplomatic service, became a representative of the Rothschilds, formed the banking house, August Belmont and Company, and made a vast fortune, kept a writing stable. His son, August Belmont Jr., bred 129 American Stakes winners, including the most famous fowl, Man of War. Now, here's a home. I think this is a little bit funny. This is a photo of August Belmont's mansion, and it was located where? Babylon, New York. This is now where the Belmont race is held. Belmont was, among many other things, an avid horse breeder and racetrack owner. He established the Belmont Park Racetrack and is the namesake of the Belmont Stakes. Should be the Schaumburg Stakes. That's a picture of him. The next is a picture where he was born. I say in Prussia, which is now called Germany. And then we got a picture of his wife. August married Carolyn Slidell. Anyone know who Slidell was? August eventually became a Democratic Party chairman. Belmont also used his influence with European business and political leaders to support the Union cause in the Civil War, trying to dissuade the Rothschilds and other French bankers from lending funds or credit for military purchase to the Confederacy, and meeting personally in London with the British Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston, and members of Emperor Napoleon III's French imperial government in Paris. Whoa, he was kind of an important guy, wasn't he? But let's get back to the history of the nation of Judah. Judah, under King Ahaz's reign, suffered similar casualties as America had suffered in its war between the states. They were defeated by Syria, and many of their people taken captive. In addition, they were also defeated by Israel, losing 120,000 men in one day, and had 1/5 of a million of their people taken captive. The Bible doesn't tell us how many men Judah lost in the battle with Syria, nor how many of its people were taken captive. But it would be close to the casualties suffered by either the North or the South in America's disastrous war. For example, Syria killed or taken captive, we'll say 100,000. Israel killed or taken captive, it was close to 400,000. So the total killed or taken captive would be 500,000 people. Now let's look at 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verses 16 and 17. It says, at that time, did King Ahaz send unto the kings of Assyria to help him. For again the Edomites had come and smitten Judah and carried away captives. Who came? So after all these casualties and defeats had happened, did the king of Judah change? No. He sent to the kings of Assyria for help. At that time refers to when the kingdom of Judah under Ahaz was defeated by Syria and Israel. This was Ahaz's first appeal to Syria for help, giving the Assyrians the occasion to meddle in the affairs of Judah. Why did Judah need to have the Assyrians to help them? They didn't. They had all the help they needed. But they refused to have the Lord to provide help to them. Again, refers to the first revolt against Judah in the days of Amzerah, 2 Chronicles 25, verses 11 through 19. King Amzerah of Judah suffered at the hands of the Edomites because he sought after their gods. Let's read 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 20. But Amzerah will not hear, for it came of God that he might deliver them into the hand of their enemies. Now, why would they be delivered into the hand of their enemies? Because they sought after the gods of Edom. Edom revolted, and this time both they and the Philistines were victorious over Judah. The Philistines also invaded Judah and captured many cities of the low country. The Edomites, brother of Jacob Israel, became the Jewish people. But they didn't worship the Talmud in the days of King Ahaz like they do today. The Talmud wasn't even in existence until they were taken captive by the Babylonians and placed in captivity. At this time in the past, the Edomites worshiped false gods but were not Jewish as they are today. They did not have a Talmud, written or oral, a Torah, or a Kabbalah. God delivered Judah into the hands of their enemies. Why? Because they sought the gods of the Edomites. Well, the north had done the same thing. They were worshiping the gods of the Edomites too. Now, who was the wizard behind the scene of the south? He was born in the Virgin Islands at St. Brooks. Now there's a map. His parents were Sephardic Jews who had moved from London to this island in the Caribbean, St. Croix, in the Dutch West Indies when it was occupied by Britain during the Napoleon Wars. His father was Philip Benjamin, and his mother was Rebecca De Mendez. His name was Judah Philip Benjamin. Philip and Rebecca had been shopkeepers in London and immigrated to the West Indies in search of better opportunities. His mother, Rebecca, had been prominent in Spain before being forced to leave under the expulsion edict of 1492. From the Virgin Islands, they moved to Wilmington, North Carolina. Then Fayetteville, North Carolina. Then to Charleston, South Carolina. In Charleston, they were with the largest number of Jews in the country at that time. At the age of 14, Judah attended Yale College, but he left without graduating. There are rumors that he was involved in gambling and other stuff, and moved to New Orleans. Another large city of Jews were there. Benjamin apprenticed at a law firm and began to study for the bar. A complicated course of action, because to become a lawyer in Louisiana, the state's use of Napoleonic code required fluency in both English and French. To fulfill this requirement, Benjamin took a job teaching to the daughter of a prominent Creole family, Natalie St. Martin, so that he could learn French. He learned French from her. He taught her English. The tutoring sessions worked well and provided unintended benefits. On February the 12th, 1833, the 21-year-old Benjamin And the 16-year-old Natalie were married. She was the daughter of a prominent and wealthy New Orleans French Creole family. Judah purchased a sugar cane plantation in Belcast, Louisiana, along with 140 slaves. As a condition of marriage, Benjamin agreed that the couple's children would be raised in the Catholic faith. Anybody married a Catholic who was not a Catholic, they had to agree to this. So they couldn't get married. The same year, Benjamin was admitted into the Louisiana bar. He soon became a law partner with the influential Louisiana politician, prominent lawyer, and plantation owner, John Slidell. Did you hear his name before in this sermon? Now, here's where it gets scary. John Slidell was born in New York and was a senator from Louisiana. The sister of his wife was married to Matthew Colbreth Perry, the man who played a leading role in opening trade with Japan. His niece was married to August Belmont, or Schlumberg, of the North. And one of his daughters was married to D. Erlanger of the French banking Rothschilds. And he was a law partner with Judah Benjamin and helped him in his political career. My head's ready to explode. To summarize, I made a chart, but it didn't come out the way it should be. But anyway, if you study this chart, you'll see that John Slidell is involved on both sides. He's got a sister of his wife. He has a daughter who's married to Frederick Erlanger. And he's got a person married to August Belmont, who it was his niece. And do you know, I found this out last night. It blew my mind. The city of Erlanger, Kentucky. Did you know this? It's about 1 mile from here. It was named after the Parisian family bank of Emily D. Erlanger, which helped finance the town's early development. Baron Emily Frederick de Erlanger, was also called Frederick Emily de Erlanger, moved to France where he directed operations of the family's parish bank. Then he began referring to himself by the French name de Erlanger. In France, he made his future wife, Marguerite Vandrille Slidell, the daughter of John Slidell, the Confederate States of America's commissioner to France. Since his wife was a Roman Catholic, he agreed to rear their four sons as Catholics. Then the Erlanger family left Paris during the Franco-Prussian War for London, England. Upon the death of his father in 1878, Frederick Emily's younger brother, Ludwig, became chief of the Frankfurt and Vienna operations, which were eventually sold in 1904. The Erlanger family floated the only foreign loans to the Confederate States of America. What? I wonder why. Called the Erlanger loan. And they made the loan to Erlanger, Kentucky, to help it build its train depot for the run to Chattanooga from Cincinnati. And there it is right there. 1852, Judah was elected by the state legislature. All the senators were elected by the legislature then. The United States Senate from Louisiana, becoming the second Jewish senator in United States history after the election of his cousin, David Levy Yulee, in 1845. He has been called the most important Jew in American public life in the 19th century. Most textbooks he's omitted. The first acknowledged Jew. Now, he was the second Jew, but he was the first acknowledged Jew. The first one hid his Jewishness. The first acknowledged Jew to serve the United States Senate, and the first Jew to be offered a seat on the Supreme Court. An offer tendered by President Millard Fillmore and declined by Benjamin just a few years before the birth of Louis Brandeis, who in 1960 would become the first Jew on the high court. All right, next. Whose picture is this here? Can you tell me? Judah Benjamin on the $2 Confederate States bill. He's pictured on the $2 bill. He's also pictured on some bonds. Judah P. Benjamin was known as the brains of the Confederacy. It's court Jew. The statesman of the lost cause. And the Confederate Kissinger. After Louisiana seceded from the Union in 1861, Benjamin resigned from his seat as the United States Senator and was appointed as the Attorney General of the Confederate States 11 days after by Jefferson Davis. In September 1861, Benjamin became the acting Confederate Secretary of War. He had never, ever had anything to do with it. He was a soldier or anything. And was later appointed as Confederate Secretary of State in March 1862 after three of the Confederate generals threatened to resign if Benjamin wasn't removed from Secretary of War. In the aftermath following the end of the Civil War, Benjamin and Davis were suspected of plotting the assassination of Abraham Lincoln carried out by John Wilkes Booth. Fearing that he would not receive a fair trial, Benjamin fled to the United Kingdom, where he became a distinguished barrister and in 1872 was appointed the Queen's Counsel. Judah Benjamin sneaks out of the United States on a boat, narrowly misses capture, and winds up in England, where he is soon the Queen's attorney. Let's connect a few of the dots. The South does not go and capture Washington, D.C. after its victory of the Battle of Bull's Run. Why didn't they do that? We're 30 miles from Washington. The Union troops fled. They just go capture Washington, D.C. A lot of people in the North didn't want to fight anyway. The war had been over. The bankers won the long war to increase the debt of both sides, the debt of both sides. England and France were to fight for the South after a few years. The nation would be split up among them. Russia sees what is happening and stops England and France from fighting for the South. They put their ships on both coasts and would declare war on anyone who interferes. Russia would pay. The loan shark bankers wanted 24% to 36% interest. Instead, Lincoln got Congress to authorize the printing of $450 million worth of greenbacks debt in interest-free money. It served as legal tender for all debts, public and private. It cost Lincoln his life. John Slidell. He dies at the Isles of Wight in England. Judah Benjamin, who has nothing to do with the military at all, became Secretary of War. He dies at Paris, France. And Friedrich D. Erlanger dies at Versailles, France. After the Confederacy surrendered, Benjamin faced federal authorities might arrest him because he had sent John Surratt, one of Lincoln's assassination conspirators, on a covert mission to Canada. Benjamin fled to Britain, where he became a wealthy barrister, never to return to the United States. Near the end of his life, he moved to Paris, reunited at long last with his wife. Unfortunately for historians, he burned his personal papers shortly before his death in 1884. Why would you burn all your personal papers? God delivered Judah into the hands of their enemies because they sought the gods of the Edomites. The South had done the same thing. They were worshiping the god of the Edomites. My conclusion. Judah Benjamin's life was a lot like Trump's, wasn't it? Trump has never spoken as highly of the American Christian people as he does of the Jewish people. Nor does our vice president or any of our politicians. It is a scandal because the Jews are not a great life-giving people, but are a race of robbers and thieves and sophisticated con men. They are not victims, but perpetrators. Will God send some judgment because of Trump's sins? 2 Chronicles 28:19. For the Lord brought Judah low because of Ahaz, king of Israel. For he made Judah naked and transgressed sore against the Lord. So King Ahaz was defeated by Syria, Israel, Edom, and the Philistines. These four enemies also took captives. He asked Assyria for help, but they didn't help him at all. In fact, the leaders of the kingdom of Judah took gifts out of the house of the Lord and the king's house and gave it to the king of Assyria, but they still did not help Judah. Ahaz made Judah naked. They were stripped of the worship and protection of the true and living God. Judah was without the help and protection of his own God. All they had to do was ask God for help. What about America? Is America stripped naked too? Our previous president is constantly said to be black, but he wasn't. He was a mongrel, the offspring of a Negro father and a Jewish mother. His mother's and grandparents' Jewish background is almost hidden to most Americans. Obama was born to a communist Jewish mother. That'd make Obama a Jew. So it shouldn't be surprising that he wound up at Columbia University, where the Frankfurt School relocated, and that he was and is a communist. And Trump? He's at least a crypto-Jew. His father, Fred, is shown in the picture, as Pastor Mark showed us below, donating land to the Jewish Center in Flatbush, New York. There's the picture Mark showed us. President Trump has four adult children, three from Ivana Trump and one from Marla Maples. Three of his four are married to Jews, and Tiffany Trump is dating a Jew. Ivana Trump is married to Jared Kushner, whose parents are both Jewish. Jared's father, Charles Kushner, is a convicted criminal and possibly a Mossad asset. Donald Trump Jr. is married to Vanessa Hayden, 38, who is a designer and mother of five children. Vanessa's mother is Danish, and her late father, Charles Hayden, was Jewish. Charles Hayden's original name was Charles Hochberg, and he was a lawyer. Next, Eric Trump is married to Lara Yuliska, who has two Jewish parents. Tiffany Trump is dating Ross Carpenter, both of whose parents are Jewish. Four generations of the Trumps, beginning with Friedrich Trump, or Drumpf, have had close business and personal associations with Jews. All four of Donald Trump's adult children have married or are dating Jews. This is no mere coincidence. When the presidential election process began, no one gave Trump any chance of becoming president. Yet there were the Jewish-controlled networks giving Trump incessant coverage, which seemed to be more than all the other candidates combined. The real deal wasn't getting Trump or Clinton elected. It was making sure the choice was limited to one between two very blackmailable and malleable candidates, that is, Clinton and Trump. Now we got a picture of the Judah B. Benjamin Memorial. Why not tear down the Judah P. Benjamin Memorial? in Bella Cass, Palamedes Parish, Louisiana. He was a slave owner, attorney general, secretary of war, secretary of state, and the closest advisor to President Davis. He was the brains of the Confederacy. He should be the primary target. They were like Hillary Clinton and Huma Abedin. Tear down all the monuments between the war between the states. But be sure to tear down the monuments to Judah P. Benjamin and to the Freemason Confederate General Albert Pike. Tear down Pike's statue in Washington, D.C. I'll give you a quote from the Protocols of Elder. It goes, quote, "The Goyim are a flock of sheep, and we are the wolves." And you know what happens when the wolves get hold of the flock? If the leaders of Judah worshiped the gods of Edom and the nation was punished by God, what will happen when America's leaders do the same thing? Blessed be the Lord God of Israel. To be continued.